Committee. Welcome, everyone. Let me announce what we're going to do and not going to do. First of all, I would like to announce that we're going to carry over Senate Bill 170, Senate Joint Resolution 4, Senate Bill 333, Senate Bill 240. And we're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 801, then move to an informational hearing on assessments, then Senate Bill 290, and then, time permitting, Senate Bill 245. Linda, if you could give us...
291.
I'm sorry.
I'm a little nervous there. Thank you.
290 has its own history, doesn't it? Let's start with a summary of 801.
Okay. Testing. Testing.
Oh, you got the pun.
Senate Bill 801 directs the State Board of Education to adopt guidelines for best practices of administering statewide assessments of students, provides that a student who met or exceeded state standards is excused from retaking the test.
Senator Bonamici, you've been kind of riding herd on this issue. Can you give us...
Sure. I'll make just a couple of comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an issue that I've been working on with Stand for Children, and the Department of Education has also been working with us. As a policymaker, but more importantly, as after 16 years as a public school parent, I heard so many stories and heard so many instances of parents, teachers, and students being concerned about over-testing. And working with Stand for Children and the Department of Education, this bill proposes guidelines for best practices in administering state assessment tests. What we're hoping to do is have the assessments that matter, but not have too many of them. I strongly believe that the over-focus on testing takes away from time for critical thinking and other instruction. And so we have Senate Bill 801, and I know we have a speaker here to talk about assessments. I'm really excited about hearing from him. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Well, yes, we have Dr. Sal from the University of Oregon, if you'd like to come up. Doctor, we understand that your testimony isn't specific necessarily to 801, but it's on the overall topic, and we thank you for taking time to come before us. I understand you rearranged some international travel plans to get here, and we appreciate that very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Vice Chair and Senator Bonamici, for having me here. And this is actually my first Oregon public appearance. I just left Michigan. I was just asking for the protocols, and if I commit any blunders, you're going to forgive me. I'm transitioning from Michigan to Oregon. Okay. There are several issues I would like to address, and feel free to stop me if time it runs on too long. You know how what a professor can do. Sometimes we can speak for hours without stopping. I'm very concerned about testing in general in the U.S., what I call the potential damages of a lot of testing to education in general in the United States. I grew up in China. My research has a lot to do around testing and its impact on children, and or to a better question, ask what knowledge is of real value in the future when we care about our students. So I would just like to say the 801, when I saw it, I said, this seems to be a very straightforward bill, and asking why are we talking about it now. I think it's simple. It's a very simple idea. We know in the U.S. in general, not particularly in Michigan, that we've seen an increase of testing taking away time from instruction, taking away our resources from improving classroom instruction, and overall, a lot of times, if look at no child left behind over the past decade or so, has not necessarily resulted in a dramatic improvement in achievement, nor has narrowed the gap in achievement among different groups, but it has reduced instructional time, reduced great resources that could go to instruction in classrooms, and has narrowed the school curriculum student learning experiences, and which I have written, and many others have written many times about potential damage of over-testing. Another thing to think about is, as I said, I grew up in China, taught in China, and I have done research in China for many years, and China is a country that would have suffered dramatically from excessive testing, and actually not China, but also Japan, South Korea, Singapore, all the countries seem to have achieved high scores on international assessments, and the way they do it is actually a lot of testing, and they prepare for testing. So what they worry about is the sacrifice of creativity, innovation, entrepreneur spirit, and a broader balanced education for children. So because what's been tested turns to be what's been taught. And I would like to say about the damage against a very well-known educational psychologist, Alfie Kong, once actually wrote something like this, said, when test scores go up, we should all worry. That is, what we should need to ask what we have sacrificed to raise test scores. So that's really in general about 801. And then let me just also talk a little bit about the recent movement in the U.S. about common assessment and the common core standards. What I have been following this since this inception of this common core ideas, what I found them, they can be very constraining to various states, and they can have a huge impact on state education activities and investment without necessarily getting the return we're looking for. First of all, people have been arguing that national standards or common standards across nation could improve the student achievement measured by test scores. That's not true, actually, if you look at national assessments. There are many countries, north of us, Canada, south of us, Australia, they do not have national standards. Their students perform quite well on international tests, such as PISA and TIMSS. And there are plenty of countries who have national standards or common standards that have not necessarily produced sufficiently high scores either. So it does not actually narrow the achievement gap either. Singapore is a very small country, always performs very high. It's about 4 or 5 minutes by the size of Oregon, has national standards and national curriculum, practiced for a long time. They actually aim to abandon that because it's not necessarily narrowed the achievement gap either. So that's with regard to, I think, the second bill talking about withdrawing from possibly common assessment as well. Because from my own research, I've seen in the age of globalization, what every state, what every child needs is a strength-based education that will make us, set us apart, not necessarily to learn the same thing or be the same as others and to go after test scores that may not necessarily reflect what will be useful in the future. And that's my beginning part of it. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Perhaps you could comment on what you know of the Oregon system and how that differs from what others are doing and what works best in your research.
I have to confess, I'm not particularly familiar with the Oregon system. I've spoken to a lot of Oregon educators, teachers. I've started this about half a year ago. But as far as I know that in Oregon, we have the potential, what they call, to be different. What I would like to say, Oregon, is not to be one of the 50 states that's going after test scores, is to be more independent. I just came back from New Zealand, actually, which, again, is a country almost a similar size to Oregon in the population. They are working towards to identify what's going to be of value in the future. I spent some time with their Minister of Education and their Minister of Education talking about designing different pathways for our students. For example, they're thinking about new academies. One of them is called Global Entrepreneurs, which I'm helping them design, that we think our students from K-12 on should have entrepreneur spirit and engage in a global perspective in our students. So over what I think in the U.S., each state needs to look at its own strength and its capacity to be different, so we do not have to put together, compete, or rank on test scores with other states.
Well, you said something very interesting in that high test scores do not necessarily equal success. And over the last decade, America, this state, have really, really gone into testing, online testing. And I guess the question would be is, just how do we measure success then if it's not in high test scores?
Mr. Chairman, actually, if you look at test scores, just a little bit history from the U.S., again, I look at more of our national systems. America has had a very long history of bad test takers. since the 19, when people talk about American education is on the decline, actually it's not. We've never been, if you use test scores as a measure, America has never been number one, not number two, not even number three. In the 1960s, in the first international mathematics and the first international science study, American students, 12th graders, ranked 12 out of 12 countries. In the 1970s, Americans in the second international and math and science study, America ranked bottom as well. Actually, since the 1990s, 2000, American students' ranking has been slightly going up in terms of mathematics, but actually at the same time coincides with a decline of assessment in creativity. Since the 1990s, American students has been dropping in ranks of creativity, which use other assessments. Now, if we take that data, look at why it does not correlate, I think President Obama, in his State of Union address this year, said that America remains the most the largest economy, most prosperous economy, most innovative economy. American workers still remains the most productive. So the question, logical question, will be going back to ask, since the 1960s, we have so many bad test takers ranked so low, so who would have been those who created this economy, maintained the innovation today? I think it has to be the bad test takers. I was actually on my flight today from here, I was looking at the new data came out of Wall Street Journal actually published patent applications. The U.S. remains still only number two after all the European Union countries combined, ahead of Japan. Even China's patents application recently is only 1/6. That's a big jump already. That's application, that is approval. So what I think test scores do not reflect what matters to a nation. And however, schools need to be held accountable. Education need to be measured in some way. What I would like to see measured would be the input factors to say what, if you look at large system, are we equally funding our schools? That's one thing. If you want to hold schools accountable, I would like to ask schools, for example, are we providing, we could have an index of educational opportunities. I think that's in the 1990s. There was discussion about how about the standards of opportunities for education. That means the diversity of education. Do you have a diversity of educational opportunities that support the whole spectrum of student talents and student interests? I spent some time in one of the so-called very best high school, actually near Chicago, New Trier High School, with the whole staff one day. One thing that impressed me most was they have so many different kind of clubs, for example, that allow students to really pursue their interests. From a personal example, when I was my daughter is going to be going to high school next year. When we were looking for high school in Oregon, her criteria and my criteria, my wife's criteria is how many after-school clubs you could have. And she found one in South Eugene High. They have a pie club. That's not a mathematical pie, but it's really the art of cooking and enjoying pie. That's for her. It's the diversity of opportunities. We could also look at other index like student engagement. I know schools in England are trying to set the measure they call happiness index. Is your children happy today? Are we engaged in those things? And there's other indexes you can look at. For example, openness. Is the school open? We can look at also leadership capacity and, of course, teacher quality. There are many other ways to look at than test scores.
That's very interesting. Very interesting. Well, I can tell you, because if someone who's tried, a fluffy pie crust is much more difficult than I understand. questions? Senator Morse?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Zhao, for sharing with us. You referenced strength-based education. Would you care to explain briefly what that would entail?
Sure. There's as in business, there's also strength-based business movement. In every company since the 1970s, been encouraged to look at what you're good at, outsource what you're not good at, and that idea has been moved over to education. Recently, there was a good book called Discover Your Child's Strength by Jennifer Fox, and there's actually a strength movement going on. The idea is that basically comes from, if you look psychologically speaking, not everybody is the same. Human diversity is there. And traditionally, we have to fix those deficits so everybody will be look the same in a large industrial society, because look at a large group of people who have the same qualities and skills. Now with the opening up of globalization technology, we have a lot more potential to make use of a diversity of talents. Just simple example in terms of job professions. Look at how many cooking shows we have now, TV. You know, before, nobody would watch cooking shows. You know, it's kind of boring, how to cook. But cooking plus entertainment is a new profession in many ways. And if you look at in the entertainment media industry or computer gaming, we have new jobs coming up. I think as the U.S. outsources a lot of manufacturing low-level skill jobs away, when you look at other domains and other possibilities. And psychologically speaking, when you are extremely weak, that's the bad news. You are extremely bad in some area, possibly you'll be good in some other area. And the reverse is true, that when you are great in something, you cannot be great in everything. You're always bad in some other areas. So the strength-based movement is rather trying to say, can we identify individual student strength and start from there and then build a balanced education, rather than trying to look at students on the deficit, fix the deficit and hold them back. A good example, and I would like to use, is looking at Michael Phelps. It's a good example, the swimmer, right? So he's not from Oregon, but we can look at him as an example. He's ADHD, but he's a good swimmer. If we hold him, well, if he had held him back, fixing his deficit, like say math or reading, he couldn't have been a good reader in the first grade or third grade. If you standardize testing today, he should fix his literacy first before he could go swim. So today, we perhaps will still be hook him on phonics somewhere, in the basement. He'll be still so that's not going to work very well. So if you start with his strength and then his confidence goes up and he could possibly develop an education and needs to be a productive member of the society. That's why I would say that how we education should start. That's why I'm also quite opposed to the idea of standardization and standardized testing. It's also my personal experience in China. It's very hard. I'm Chinese, but I'm not very good at mathematics. Maybe you can say that's why I'm a sick refugee in Oregon. That's not a reason. But I do computer programming. I do statistics quite well. I understand it very well. So if you use one way to measure, that I would be held back. And luckily, in the 1980s, when I went to take the college entrance exam, 1982, that's the last year in China, if you say you studied English, they could forgive you for not knowing mathematics. So my math score did not count toward college entrance exam. That's why I'm here. I studied English not because I liked it, because I was bad at mathematics. So this, that's what look at strength, not for fixing a deficit.
Follow-up? Thank you. The Oregon assessment on knowledge and skills, your thoughts on that? The Oaks program.
I'm not familiar with that program particularly. I actually was trying to think about 12 years ago, Oregon was moving towards a portfolio assessment system, I remember. I think there was, I don't know how far that went, that overall. If we went more portfolio, of course, it's getting more expensive, think about assessment, much more expensive, but might be better for education. And speaking of, I don't know about this specific description. If the vice chair would care to let me just briefly introduce, I might be able to say something about it, because I know about different schemes of describing knowledge and skills.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I was just going to say that I know many won't make any curriculum, many basic description of standards of skills and knowledge. We generally have different ways of doing things, doing that. One way is to, based on our past knowledge, to say what we need for the future. So we have a general set of knowledge described, or core curriculum or local curriculum, and then sometimes we can describe based on the future, so to interview. So I don't know which part of Oregon is, but what's happening right now around the globe in different countries is the people are really trying to reshuffle that to say, is it truly, for example, does everyone need algebra 2? That's a good example, even though we try to argue for that, that's good. Does everyone need this and that, and is numerous and literacy is so important that we should sacrifice anything else, because when you include something as the core, you in essence are pronouncing others as non-core. A good example would be England. England has been practicing national standards, it's up 70-some million people, since about 15 years now. 2 years ago, Cambridge University professor Robin Alexander came out with a big review of 10 years of national standards and national assessment, national ranking of schools. The summary basics is this, is that we have seen test scores in literacy and numeracy improving for the first few years, but we have deprived our children of a real education. And last year, about half of British primary schools boycotted the national test. They basically didn't take the test. They could not compile the Lincoln because those educators thought the way to go after those test scores and ranking, they call national league tables, like on the football or something like league tables, is not healthy for education. And someone actually recently, we've been discussing, this may be like when you go after those test scores, like Easter Islanders trying to build bigger giant stone heads and eventually destroy themselves because they're going after something that's not very meaningful. So while I cannot specific comment on the Oregon specifics, but I would like to say what we need broadly is a much broader educational experience for our students in which would allow schools, teachers, and students to build on their strengths.
Thank you. Senator Barmecha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Zhao, when I heard you speak before, you talked about how sometimes we're compared, the United States test scores are compared with China or Japan or Finland or other places. And I know you've sort of touched on that, but if you want to just tell us a little bit about why that doesn't make sense.
Senator Hass and Senator Morrison, Senator Barmecha, the idea is that when I look at those countries, I was actually involved in some of this assessment discussions, for example, around PISA, around TIMSS. When you look at different countries, every country has its cultural preference for what they want to go after. A specific example would be China's recent ascendance to be number one in the last year's PISA release. I think everybody has heard about that. And shortly after that was the Chinese Tiger Mom become very popular, if you remember that a while back. And if you look at Finland and Alberta up north in Canada, Ontario, they all kind of rank high. I think when we do these comparisons is that we ignore a lot of cultural practices and family practices and preferences. And therefore, we only also look at what they've gained, we forgot to look at what they've lost in the pursuing of those things. And another thing is that if you look at, actually it's a good example when you ask this. Last month, I was asked to speak at a conference jointly organized by Alberta and Finland. Both are high performing countries. I mean, Alberta is not a country, but it's an independent system. Their question, they asked me to go there, is to talk about the post-PISA era. So we are scoring very high, now what? Because that does not necessarily predict or indicate they will do better in any other domains. So that's why another reason I said, first of all, different countries have different choices to go after different things. And second of all, different factors contribute to that. And third of all, those do not necessarily measure the capacity or our skills we need to succeed in the future. And that's why when I talk, I would not normally try to go compare in that sense. If, for example, if you want to say why Finland succeeded, we're talking about Finland. So Finland, we actually was joking with some of their education leaders in Edmonton last night. I said, if you bring in 5% of people who are not Finn come to your country, can you still maintain the same test scores in 5 years? It's a big diversity challenge. It's different, very kind of questions, different situations.
Okay, and just a follow-up. I think this is related to your after-school pie club story. You also mentioned when I heard you speak before that you thought one of the best things that could happen in schools is talent shows. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because
yes,
it really resonated with me.
That's, I've been observing it for a lot. I said, many people in other countries come to the U.S. asking the question, how do Americans teach creativity? They always come to ask questions. Singapore's, their minister was sent here, perhaps every year, many, many groups. China is planning to send about 10,000 school principals overseas. Most of them come to the U.S. to find out, how do you teach creativity? So they ask me, I said, I don't know. I said, I go to school, I said, where's your creativity unit? Nobody has it. And how do they do it? And how everybody thinks U.S. is more creative. You look at that, actually shows that in that way. And so I began to examine this. My children went through American schools. I look at it, I said, okay, creativity is much more than a cognitive skill. Look at modern social research around creativity shows that typically a family who produce more creative people have fewer than three rules. Those who are less creative have many more rules. I said, well, if you apply that to schools, so I would go to school talent shows. You go to school talent shows, very interesting. School talent shows, well, a lot of them, you may not even call that talent, you know. So a lot of, but you see these kids going up there, some are doing violin, some doing taekwondo, some doing piano, some doing all kinds of things there. That shows, to me, creativity is being able to express yourself, to have confidence in yourself that allow you to be recognized as such. So I went back to coin the term, I said, creativity is born, it cannot be taught, but it can be killed. American schools don't teach it better, we kill it less successfully. That's my kind of conclusion. And school talent shows as such environment indeed cultivates that. There's actually a little bit more data about that. Is the 2003 TIM study, the third international mathematics science study, shows American students rank way behind Asian education systems, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, South Korea. But in the same test, they have another set of questions asked. Are you confident you can do mathematics? And do you like mathematics? Do you think you would? Do you think you might pursue mathematics? Those questions, they generally categorize as happiness with mathematics or confidence scores. And the data shows just the opposite. Americans may be ignorant, but they are very confident. The scores do not go very high, but they're confident. They like mathematics more than the Singaporeans. Those countries rank at the bottom. So that after 2003 data, Singaporeans, Hong Kong educators have been worried about how to improve confidence. How can we make curriculum more relevant to students? More relevant, not rigorous. So they've been reducing math content by one third. In the U.S., the interpretation is that our kids are too happy. That's why their scores don't go up. And that's the Brooks Institute. They said, we got to, maybe relevance doesn't matter. So they've been talking about doing more mathematicians. So that's why I think things like talent shows represents one type of philosophical foundations that other countries may not have, especially Asian countries, is the tolerance for diversity of talents and a celebration of individual passion and possibilities and allow the space for students to grow. And I think talent shows are just one example of the many things we do in our schools.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions or comments?
Well, just a rhetorical question, Mr. Chair. Has anyone ever sat down and looked at the breadth of what we spend money on and determine what we're spending for assessments and testing out of our appropriation of $5.7 billion? What percent is spent on assessments?
Virginia, Wisconsin, Minnesota have commissioned studies on overall the cost of implementing No Child Behind requirements and assessment testing. Wisconsin, I don't remember exactly data showing that each year they call about millions of hours were lost for either preparing to take the test or taking the test, and they've added a burden to the reporting system as well.
Well, we thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your appearance here and your information. It was great.
Thank you, Chairman.
Before Dr. Zalvis, would you mind just telling us your background? Because I don't think we established it. I know you're a professor, but...
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. I am now the first university, actually a presidential chair at the University of Oregon, and also Associate Dean for Global Education at College of Education at University of Oregon. Before that, I was a University Distinguished Professor at Michigan State University College of Education for about 15 years.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Zell. We do have a couple of other people that we'd like to hear from on this bill, Senate Bill 801, Dana Hepper and Dana Hillams.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, thanks for your consideration of Senate Bill 801. First, I want to thank Senator Bonamici for working so closely with us to draft this legislation and get it right. And I also want to say it's really not fair to put me on after Dr. Zell. You're just going to have to trust me. I have many strengths that I may not be demonstrating today. Just quick background, obviously our federal government began to tie school and district level consequences to the outcomes of students' scores on standardized tests in the No Child Left Behind law. And, you know, I think we all care strongly about making sure that students are learning at high levels, that they have a rich curriculum, and that they're prepared to be successful in the world and follow their dreams. What we want to avoid as we strive toward that goal is narrowing the curriculum, lowering the standards, and myopically focusing on just the results of one standardized assessment. And I acknowledge Senate Bill 801 doesn't get us there, right? There are a lot of things in our assessment system that we really need to take a hard look at, but we're hoping that it takes it one step, and I think as we're seeing here today, sparks an important conversation about what we assess in our public school system. So what Senate Bill 801 does do and why we're supporting it is it asks the State Board to adopt best practice standards for the use of Oregon's statewide standardized assessment. Without guidance, many districts have developed incredibly thoughtful and appropriate plans for using OAKS in their school district, and some districts have not. And we, you know, as Senator Bonamici is hearing this, we're hearing it from parents in the field and from teachers as well. And Dina is going to share, you know, her personal experience with OAKS testing in her classroom, and I think that'll be enlightening. Given that in this vacuum our plans are all over the map, we think it's time to put some best practices out there to support districts in using this one assessment appropriately for students. The second thing it does is it puts one of the best practices that we think is critically important into law, which is that if a student has passed the test, they can't be required to take that test again. And you know, there are a couple reasons why we hear school districts may retest students who have demonstrated proficiency. One, there is a weight in the state report card that if more of your students get to the exceeds level on the state test, it can help you reach the highest rating on the state report card. And Stanford Children and a number of other organizations at Department of Ed are in conversations about whether it's worth relooking at the state report card and eliminating that kind of incentive to retest students who have already demonstrated proficiency so that those students can spend time doing other things that may be more valuable uses of their time. And then you know, I think frankly there's just a logistics question. I think some schools haven't yet figured out what to do with the students who are proficient in their grade level content area while the other students take the test again. And so we think that's just a worthwhile thing to ask school districts to figure out, and we know that they can, and we'd be happy to, you know, help in those conversations. Ultimately our goal here that we think we take a baby step toward is reducing the time spent taking this one statewide standardized test, which can, you know, increase the availability of computer labs for other learning purposes for students, which can free up teacher and student time to use other kinds of hands-on, real-time formative assessments that are more useful to teachers and students, and to increase time for learning. These are the things that we're really driving at, and we hope we take a step toward that with this legislation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dina?
Great. Thank you, Chair Haas and other members of the committee for the opportunity to speak to you in support of 801 today. As a point of reference, I am a mom of three in North Clackamas. I've taught for 18 years in the Reynolds School District. I'm an OEA member and a Stand for Children member in North Clackamas as well. I think like Dana said, I believe in the purpose and place of having an assessment that's high quality, well calibrated, so that we can see where students are, both on an individual basis for the student, for the parents, and also to look at the general population. I don't have a problem with that. I do take issue with the overtesting that takes place at my school. I teach 7th grade in high poverty middle school, and I lose 15 to 20 instructional days in 7th grade to testing. When you think about that, you know, 36 weeks in the school year, it's nearly half a quarter that I lose to that. So at my school, what we do, 7th graders, they take their first round of the OAKS test in the fall. And all students have to take the first two rounds. Because we're 48 minutes, I lose the full week for that. My advanced kids, who are my last period of the day, 39 kids in that class, 33 of them exceeded first round, 5 of them met, and one kiddo was off by 1 point. Rather than being able to use that additional time, that second round, to engage in curriculum, they needed to be tested again. So they missed that. Also, January through March, it's frequently a time of great academic growth that we see, and I try and capitalize on that as a teacher. But what I experienced this year is my efforts were a bit thwarted by over-testing again. The last week we did the state writing test, which I actually regard as a well-thought-out test. That takes 5 days, and then the week after, they began the second round of reading tests again. So then I lost a second week. The following week, they started the second round of the math test that they needed to do as well. So in a period of about 4 weeks, my students had spent 3 weeks of their time testing, which just seems a little overkill. We also found with that second round that making all the 7th graders take that test only resulted in about 10% of kids moving in their categories. So I think there's a question of, is that a good efficiency of time and use for those students? And now that we're gearing up for our third round of testing, it's for students who are within 6 points of meeting benchmark. Not only are those students going to lose 5 more days in my class, currently we're reading the novel Hiroshima, we're looking at primary sources, they're getting acquainted with the Socratic method and doing some really high-level thinking. Instead, not only will they be being tested, but they're going to be pulled out from classes to tutor for this test exclusively. At this point in the year, that test is going to be of very little value or use for the student. It's not going to be of value to the parents or really me. It's really an incentive for the district. And, you know, my guess with all of these is that there was never the intent. I sort of got the feeling that everybody had good intentions of having all these flexible opportunities for schools to meet these goals, but the way it gets carried out in title schools is drastically different than you might find in other places. Dana had briefly spoke about the use of technology. My school, there's 1,000 kids. We have 2 testing labs. We have only 1 testing lab that's actually available, so 30 computers, and most of my classes are over 30, by the way, too, so that becomes difficult. But we only have 30 computers for 1,000 kids to actually use technology to learn. My 7th grader, who attends school in another district where there's not such an emphasis on the testing, he has had the ability to really learn and apply all kinds of incredible technology that's really helped him with his learning. So what it means for that other computer lab is from mid-September to the end of May, it can't be used because it is used for testing from the moment school starts in the day till the time it ends at the end of the day. So that's pretty frustrating. I know some of it is due to our own state report card formulas and certain aspects of No Child Left Behind, but it does seem that it's damaging. Just last week, we had 2 students who've just came here from Zimbabwe 2 or 3 weeks ago. They don't speak English. They speak French. But next week, they get to take the science and math test in English for 8th grade. So I'm just hoping that something like this is a start towards creating better communication with ODE, with schools, about the intent and use of best practices. And I would love to have some of those 15 to 20 days back to really engage my students in the rich curriculum I want to provide them with. That's it.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Anyone else here on Senate Bill 801? Now, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 801, and I'd like to go to our informational hearing on assessments. And we have a couple of different teams here. Why don't we start off with Representative Comp, who's joined us. Representative Betty Comp.
I think I'm a member of your committee now.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Haas and committee. I'm going to ask your indulgence because this subject is very important to me, and I'd rather not speak just to not stick to my script, but because there's so many key pieces that I don't want to miss, I'd appreciate if you'd allow me to stick to the, to follow along at a, with a script. This is something that I've been working on. Oh, for the record, my name is Betty Comp. I serve House District 22, and that's Woodward Jervis as well as Northeast Salem. I have served at the national level for 3 years, and we developed a book that is about education at the crossroads, and it was published 2010, and we had experts, literally experts from all over the nation talking to us about our constitutional rights, the federal constitutional rights to assessment. And this started my journey into looking at what is best for our students. And so today I would say, before you today is Senate Bill 974, which would direct the Department of Education to enter into assessment contracts with exceptions. My testimony also is going to touch on Senator Bonamici's bill on the same topic, Senate Bill 801. My background of a special education teacher, school administrator, and principal gives me some insight into the topic of assessment. Personally, I hate taking tests. I had to take my driver's test twice. It's just not something I find fun to do. So when I was first hired as a teacher in 1990, there was not an assessment available for my students to tell me what were their reading and writing levels. To my dismay, after a couple of weeks, it wasn't very hard for me to tell that almost every one of my students was pre-literate and did not know how to write, and these were high school students. It didn't take a summative assessment to figure that out. More importantly, I had no resource to tell me what areas they really needed help on. Today, April 14, 2011, 21 years have passed, and teachers in Oregon still don't have a formative assessment to know the levels of their students. With a formative assessment, teachers can find out their level at the beginning of the year, monitor growth, and also see which areas that they have their strengths and their weaknesses. For the past 4 years, I have served on these national committees. National Conference of State Legislatures has published the report, and in the report it says, federal policy should encourage an appropriate interpretation of data derived from formative testing so that deficiencies in a student achievement are addressed when initially diagnosed. 2 weeks ago, I was in North Carolina attending an incredible conference called Making the Grade. Again, the discussion was founded on the premise that formative assessments are the teaching tool that gives value to students, parents, and teachers, and encourages learning-based outcomes. We talk about with the governor's vision and agenda that we're going to be talking about student outcomes. That's student outcomes to see how many students finish their baccalaureate degree, students that finish their associate's degree, and students that finish high school. That is a goal that we've been talking about, Senator Haas and some of us, for what, about 5 or 6 years to do the 20-40-40. We in Oregon, we do take our time in making good deliberative judgments. Oregon has spent 20 years developing a summative test that students take up to 3 times a year, is what you've just heard, And our students are by far more focused on taking the test than they are about learning. I also want to address some cost figures. We spend $4.5 million per year on our current assessment system, plus an additional upwards to $3 million to staff for that test. All we get is a summative assessment, a snapshot of one moment in time. And I would say that one moment in time might be a stellar moment in time, or somebody might have a toothache, or your family just had a big fight the night before. There are multitudes of variables that one snapshot in time can be skewered one way and the other. We can spend less money on separate tests that give us formative and summative results to ensure accountability. Currently, this is why teachers hate tests. Currently, students are tested on proficiency in math, reading, writing, science, and English, how well they're learning English from grades 3 through 12. It used to be we had them in different years. So I checked on the federal requirements. Today's federal requirements are No Child Left Behind Act only requires us to test reading, math in grades 3 through 8, as well as once between grades 10 through 12. We are testing a lot more time and students than is what is required. It also requires us to test science once between grades 3 and 5, 6 and 9, 10 and 12, a total of 3 times. These tests are being given to our students yearly. Testing writing is not required, but is currently being required by the State Board of Education. The cost of the test is $11 to $13 per pupil, much higher than our peer states. The new Smarter Balance Assessment Consortium that the State Board of Education has adopted will cost approximately $19.81 per student test. How can we justify such a cost increase? And if you're wondering when all this happened, it happened last June with no legislative oversight. The legislature was cut completely out of the process. Yet we are expected to adjust our budgets, take more money from schools with little or no positive impacts on our student learning. Now for the most shocking news, the current contract is in place for until 2013. But that's not all. If there's no problems, there's going to be a concurrence that contract be renewed for another 10 years. This allows the negotiation to extend well beyond 2014 to negotiate for another 10 years. That is, unless we as members of this legislature, we the people that want to make sure that our students have learning outcomes, not a test score on a RIT scale, that our students are learning. We need to do something about it. This contract is contrary to the work of the Governor's Education Design Team. The investment board is being set up only to walk into a long-term contract that they're going to be required to stick with. I ask you, do we want to support the actions of the Department of Education and our State Board of Education? I can't say it any stronger. As a teacher, as a mom, as a principal, as a legislator, the answer is no. We need a formative assessment that guides our teacher instruction, not a once, two, three times a year score, again, a RIT score that a parent doesn't even know what it means, to say this is what your child's learning. I suggest that we seek out a very public process with public input, utilize the research that's out there in the field, and decide. I think we have an obligation to have a voice in this discussion. It should not be decided in one meeting with the State Board of Education. it should not be done through the governor's continuum of their association, nor the state schools, the superintendents. As a member of the National Conference of State Legislators, I have heard time and time again how we as legislators haven't been available to do these opportunities. This is the exact reason why the state of Texas said, no way, we won't go. We're not going to follow this form of assessment that we're going to do this. They are the one state in this union, and I know they only have to drill a couple more oil wells to provide the funding for their students in schools, but we in Oregon look at our environment a little differently. And we as members really do need to take a long look at this. I agree with Senator Bonamici. We're testing way too much, way too frequently, and we really don't know what our students are getting out of it. I know what our teachers are getting out of it. They're getting a big headache. When I talk to teachers in my community, I ask them, I said, what can we do for you? And they said, stop some of this testing. And I said, does that include the writing test? And they said, absolutely. Why are we testing all these students every year if we only have to test them three times in a six-year cycle? So somehow the test is controlling education, not the teachers, not the parents. And with that, I could go on and on, as you can tell, on this subject, but I do want to just ask your diligence to make sure that this subject has more time to be heard and we get more information. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kopp, and your passion for education is showing through. So.
Well, thanks.
Any questions for Representative Kopp? Senator Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kopp, for your testimony. And I don't know if you were here when Senator Morse asked a question about wondering about how much money is spent on testing, and you helped answer that with your testimony. I wanted to ask, in your testimony, you talk about the $11 to $13 per pupil and then the $19.81 per student. Is that per student per academic year or per student per test?
I've asked that exact question, and what I've been told is it is more of an average per student per year, not per test.
But I have department's not, here, and I hope they'll be able to.
Yeah, I have okay. not gotten a definitive understanding on that point.
Thank you.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Response to Senator Bonamici. I would suggest that the opportunity cost is the larger of the expense of assessments. It's the lost time that could have been spent more productively. I mean, and has that been quantified? And we had a previous witness that did, at least anecdotally, share her experience. And, assessment, we need assessments. We need to know where we're going. We need to students need to have some sense of migrating towards accomplishment. But if we're doing it in such an excessive way, it's the opportunity cost that is probably the greater.
Well, co-chair, I'm so used to being in the house. Chair. Chair Hass.
I'll take the co-chair, too.
Chair Hass and Senator Morris, I guess that's what started fueling my fury, is because as a teacher in 1990-91, we really embraced the 21st Century Schools Act. And from that point until just recent time, we've had, I don't know how many people, the fiscal resources of people working at the department writing this summative assessment. Oregon should be congratulated for having one of the only few adaptive tests that we do online, which saves us quite a bit of money. We're to be commended on that. But we have, and again, we have personnel that are getting paid full-time to write these assessments, and not that they shouldn't be receiving PERS and health care, but that's with all the other pluses that go along with that. And now, after 20 years, are we just going to throw all that work out and take the guidance from Smarter Balance, which is this national coalition of 31 states, and start all over, because my feeling is we need to have a formative assessment right now. Formative assessments are available. If we're going to reach our 2040 goals, another 4 years to get another assessment written is a long time. And the one thing our students don't have is time to rework a whole nother system. So if we have something in place that can already do it without all the personnel cost and those types of things, yes, those are all considerations that would have to be reflected, and I'm sure legislative fiscal will help us figure out what those costs may be. But those are the types of discussions and debates I think we need to have.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
See you tomorrow. Okay, let's bring up Matt Chapman's team. Matt's CEO of Northwest Evaluation Association. Great.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, for the record, Jack Esselman, appearing today on behalf of Northwest Evaluation Association. As you mentioned, I'm joined by our CEO, Matt Chapman, and I am here merely to display my strength in pushing buttons.
Over to Matt.
Chair Hass and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Matt Chapman. I'm the president and chief executive officer of the Northwest Evaluation Association, and greatly appreciate the opportunity to be here today because, as Rep. Comp has pointed out, these are extraordinarily important issues. And unfortunately, these have been issues that have not been something you could talk about. And that's really weird, because I can't imagine very many things that we all care about more than how our children are doing and what is best for them in the context of education. So what I would like to do is to address some of the choices that are before us and such. In that context, you can push the button now, Jack.
Okay.
He's very useful, by the way. Let me just give you, I'll spend but a moment on this, in terms of who Northwest Evaluation is and what we're about. We are a not-for-profit based in Oregon, and our approach is all about educational services. That's what we do. We don't do anything else. We are not, and I stress this, we are not an accountability assessment company. That's not what we do. So there is that factor. The ironic history is we actually began as a spinoff 34 years ago of the research department of Portland Public Schools. And the question that that remarkably bright group of researchers sought to answer is the question. One of the questions we're still working with today. They had the image of, gee, what if you could take the academic progress of a child, and for purposes of measuring growth, the child is wherever she or he is, and we could do, maybe, the same thing that we all do as parents, and I remember doing this with my two kids, is you back them up against the wall, if for some reason in American society it must be the kitchen, and you measure how tall they are. And it's not that it's the right height, it's just how tall they are today. And a year later, you measure, did they grow? Well, they do, and so on and so forth. And the concept that these folks had is, if we could wind up measuring that and focus on where the child is and begin to learn what are the things that are needed in order to enable that child to grow maybe a bit faster academically, that would be a really good thing. Well, I'll save you all the history. It turns out the answer to that is yes, you can do that. That's what we've done for 34 years, and that's what we do today as well. In that context, and I joined the company just about 4.5 years ago, we have begun to have very serious success. Well, actually, we've had it for a long time now, But it's accelerated a fair amount. So the year before I joined, we had $26 million in revenue. The year that we're now finishing in June, this year we'll have 72. We know that we'll cross well beyond 80 next year, and we are at a growth rate that is extremely rapid and continuing to do well. The other thing, because there is an economic development message here that's a critical part of what I frankly need to bring to you today, we are very much an Oregon organization. And I have 320 colleagues in Portland, or throughout the state. Some of them work outside Portland. But within the state of Oregon, of the 420 employees of NWA, 320 are in Oregon. It's about a $30 million payroll as we're projecting it to be by the end of this year, and that's quite a lot of growth from where we were even recently. Our average job is worth about $80,000 a year. So these are not exactly, cheapo whatever. The process is one where with that, I need to explain, if I may, a little bit of one of the, whether it's intended or unintended consequences, I'm not sure, but one of the results of spending the kind of time and money, and particularly the time, that we do on the accountability, which for us is the Oaks test, but would be expanded greatly under Smarter Balance in terms of the amount of time that would be taken by state-mandated tests. It has the effect, to be perfectly candid, of jeopardizing organizations like NWA. And that's one of the reasons that I have raised these issues with a number of you. It's one of the issues of some concern, because the real reason not to proceed ahead with the expansion of state control represented by Smarter Balanced, one of the reasons to, beyond the issues behind 801, the real reasons are, we need to do what's right for our kids. And the overtesting is clearly, clearly wrong for kids. Making it even more overtesting would be even more wrong. But let's take a look, and Jack, you get to press another button, about what it is that is really involved. Now, as I mentioned, and the process is one where what NWA is about is we are an organization that provides assessment for the purpose of learning. We do not do assessment of learning. That is an incredibly important distinction. If you recall Dr. Zhao's comments, and I thought he, by the way, philosophically, I just met him just at the before the hearing, I think I found a soulmate. The process, when he talks about strength-based education, is precisely the concept that NWA has been built on now for our 34 years. Because when you measure how that kid has grown, the process is one in which we can figure out, through our assessments, what areas is the kid really strong on? What areas is the kid really struggling with? Let's figure out how we help the kid where the kid struggles, but let's also focus on the areas of strength, because those areas of strength will accelerate. And by the way, our assessment research, which is what we do as a not-for-profit, indicates that for children on average, about 50% have what we call an idiosyncratic learning pattern. What that means is that there is something that child is particularly great at or particularly not great at that is way beyond where the child performs otherwise. So we can help the child and the parents and the teachers being most important, identify what are the things that are issues of strength, and we can tie that to learning opportunities. As a consequence of that, if you look at the growth of NWA nationwide, it's been pretty significant. You're on. And what that shows is that over the last, I think that's about an eight-year chart, something like that, over about the last 8 years nationally, we have grown to the point where NWA tests about 5 million children nationwide. That's about 10% of the children in the United States. And we are continuing to grow. And one of the things that is really exciting about that is that we are in some very, very cool places. We are partnered with KIPP Schools, which is one of the most exciting charter programs around. We work with Teach for America. We work with some of the toughest schools in South Carolina, where we have essentially all of the school districts, and help them to measure growth in areas like Beaufort, which is where the nation's war on poverty began, and sadly is still underway. But we're able to help those teachers understand the nature of what is going on and how they best can help those kids accelerate. We're in some of the highest performing schools, like Plano in Texas, where 55,000 kids use our assessments increasingly on really fancy stuff like iPads, to be in a position to accelerate growth. Because pretty much all, it's like Lake Wobegon down there. They all exceed expectations. So you've got that. We've been able to compete with really large companies. We just unlocked the city of Chicago's public schools. They made a decision to open up to be the choice of the school units, the areas within their group, to use not only their traditional provider, Scantron, which is part of a huge, huge international organization, make everything from lipsticks to bank checks to Scantron stuff. And I have a lot of respect for those guys. But the districts in the schools in Chicago now have two choices as of a week ago. They can use Scantron or they can use NWEA. And we beat Scantron in a really, really tough bake-off. And quite frankly, I think we will, we already have about 70,000 of the schools or the children in Chicago. We intend to get all 400,000. We have a pilot of great interest at New York City. So it's not a case of we can't compete. And my competitors traditionally are really large organizations like Pearson, which is multi-billion dollars international, McGraw-Hill, which is, again, multi-billion dollar international organizations, and on and on. I have a new one now, which is Wireless Generation, which is owned by News Corp, and they just put $360 million into it. But I'm not concerned about what happens with them. We have better products. I am a believer in the marketplace. I used to run a publicly traded company, so I think I've got the credential for that one. And I really don't, I'm not that worried. I mean, I worry about a lot of things, but I'm not that worried about my ability to compete with those kinds of organizations, even though they are giant and even though they are vastly better funded than anything we could do. We are focused. We know what we're about. We know what we're good at. What I cannot compete with is a situation where the entire activity for assessment is mandated and occupied by a state. So let's look at our growth rate in Oregon. Right now, whereas we have more than I think it's 275% growth over that same time period, we have essentially no growth and no presence in our own home state. And the reason for that is not because we don't care and not because we haven't been trying. The reason for it is that the Oaks test occupies the field. And in order to be in a position to also use the MAP test, which is our product, then a school district has to basically double test. And this is in part because the Oaks test is a three-time-a-year test, whether that's needed or not. And you've heard some very articulate testimony as to those issues. I can't compete against that. But it actually gets worse, and the reason that we've raised this issue is it's about to get a whole lot worse with the Smarter Balance Consortium. Oregon is the leader, in reality, of the Smarter Balance Consortium. The consortium is basically the propagation of the Oaks test tied to incremental tests, which, although they're not in fact formative, are being characterized as formative. And that is, if you go back to the various areas of testimony and explanation by the leadership of the Smarter Balance Coalition, what we're looking at is potentially 31 states where the Oregon test and the experience I've had in Oregon is what I'm going to be facing. So I admit I have a dog in this fight. Now, I stress, it's not that we want to do accountability tests. We don't. I don't know whether we'd be good at it or not. That's not what we're about. We're about formative. We're about instruction. We're about figuring out what are those strengths that we can inform a teacher about so the teacher can build on the learning and become more effective. And this isn't speculation on my part. Sometime back, a year or so ago, there was a contest in the state of Delaware to figure out what the Delaware test would be. One of the senior members of the Oregon Department of Education was a consultant to the state of Delaware and wound up helping them to design their test. They designed their test in such a way that it occupies not only the summative side, but also the interim side. And the vendor that the state of Oregon has chosen was the successful vendor. And I don't, you know, I'm not, you know, complaining about the process. I'm complaining about the fact that in this kind of a context, with this kind of a structure that is now about to be propagated nationwide, the results for an organization like NWEA are disastrous. And let me illustrate what happened. We had grown to the point we had 60% of the students in Delaware running with our, or using our assessment for purposes of their instructional. We never had the accountability test in Delaware. That's down to basically zero, because the Oaks-style approach, enhanced by adding more assessments that appear to be formative, now occupies the entire field in the state of Delaware. And so, you know, we have lost 60,000 kids, not a lot of kids in Delaware, so I guess I'm glad of that. But the process is one in which that's what is going on, and that is what is being propagated in terms of smarter balance. I think that is inappropriate. I also think, as Representative Kopp has said, that this is an issue that ought to be discussed in the sunlight. This is an issue that you folks, as legislators, should be incredibly involved in, if not ultimately making the decisions. And that has not been the reality. This should not be, for example, I would suggest, an area in which what we're dealing with is where folks like myself need to, in fact, approach this topic and think about whether we're going to raise these issues out of fear. It has already been the case this week at the American Educational Research Association that a very senior member of one of the D.C. groups has approached one of my people and said, if you folks continue doing what you're doing in Oregon, it's going to be very bad for your organization. I don't think that's appropriate. I think that that is the kind of thing that engenders the sort of fear, and this is a very high-risk presentation for me to make. I think that what it engenders is an inappropriate approach by state departments of education to squelch the conversations that actually need to happen. What I am asking you to do is to consider some of the alternatives. And one of these, I want to do a little quick setup here, and this is the last of what I have in my presentations. I want to play a 3-minute and 10-second video of a fellow by the name of Rick Stiggins. Rick wanted to be here today. His travel did not permit that. Rick is the founder of the assessment ATI, I forgot what the D stands for. He is probably if he's not the world's leading authority, he's certainly the world's leading practitioner in the area of formative assessment. By the way, Rick's company is based in Portland, Oregon. And he has a real passion for what needs to happen. And what Rick has asked me to do is, on his behalf, to encourage you to take the kind of steps. He is very supportive of Senate Bill 974 and of not allowing the basic process of accountability assessment to occupy the field. There is a better way to look at this. There are other kinds of areas where, in an overview of assessment, we can be in a position where we have assessment for learning, as well as needed, and in my opinion, in a very minimalist way, assessment of learning. So if you'll bear with me, and if Jack hits the right button, let's hear.
Now, I want to begin with a very strong assertion. I'm contending that we either change some fundamental assessment beliefs and act accordingly, or this achievement score gap that we've been obsessing about is not going to narrow. Regardless of whatever else we do on behalf of closing the achievement score gap, unless we deal with the inherent assessment issues, the gap will not narrow. In order to accomplish this, I'm going to suggest to you that it's important that we take 7 specific actions. Let me tell you what they are, and then I want to analyze them according to certain factors. First of all, we need to balance our assessment systems. And I'm going to talk about that in just a few minutes. Secondly, we must continue our work to refine our academic achievement expectations. Third, we must assure that all assessments used in all contexts absolutely do accurately reflect the achievement of our students. Number four, we need to think more deeply about how to turn the learners into the assessors during their learning. In addition, we need to continue to rethink the manner in which we deliver feedback to or communicate about student achievement in the service of student success. Six, we need to build the confidence of all learners. Leave all learners believing that success is within reach for them if they keep trying. Now let me stop there for a second. What I'm going to argue is that these are all things that place teachers right at the center of the assessment universe. Our point here is that the assessment key to truly effective schools resides in the classroom, not in the boardroom or the state legislature. It's not that federal testing requirements and state assessments are unimportant. It's that the other 99.9% of the assessments that happen in a kid's life, the ones that drive their learning, happen at the behest of their teacher day to day in the classroom. If these are working well, then students prosper. If they're done poorly, students suffer. Teachers haven't been trained to do it well. Action number 7 is to get those teachers the opportunity to learn. That takes assertive leadership. 7 essential strategies. I say to you again, we've reached a tipping point. Fail to adopt the beliefs that we're going to talk about here and the actions that come with them in the immediate future. Fail to do this, and the achievement gap, the struggling learner, will not begin to succeed, regardless of whatever else we do, unless we address the assessment issues.
So with that, I would be pleased to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Matt. I think I can say with certainty that everybody on this committee wants your company here to succeed.
Thank you.
The world of testing and assessments has evolved to become such a sophisticated, technical, complicated area. At what point is it appropriate, as you suggested, for legislators to weigh in on this? And at what point is it micromanaging for us to get involved at this level of technical process in our educational system?
I think, Chair Haas, that's a very, very perceptive question, because that balance, which is one that you folks obviously need to be the people who decide, is very important. I think that the core here is that it is appropriate for the legislature, and in particular, as much, much closer to the people who are involved in this thing, like parents and students and such, needs to set the policy and needs to set the priorities. Certainly, I would not anticipate that you folks would decide whether or not this assessment or that assessment is the right answer. That requires expertise that is not typically present. Rep Comp could probably do it, and you could make a committee of one, and I think we'd all be fine. But other than that, the process is one where what I think the real roles here are that the policies and the choices that are being made need to be surfaced. They need to be articulated. And so on the one hand, yes, I think you set those and you provide that direction. But I think you also need to provide the form, as you're doing today. And what needs to occur is that those who are making the decisions need to be in a position where they are making them in the sunshine, where they're making them with full involvement and understanding of the implications, both financial and in terms of the assessments, where they need to answer questions such as, you know, if you have an overall assessment that is going to do summative and formative and all of that together, because of the summative, does that in fact not drive out the role of the classroom and the role of the teacher. Those are not questions that are going to get asked pretty much in any other kind of form. And I would encourage you to continue to take that responsibility and to interject yourself into these processes. Right now, we are on a course, as Rep. Comp has mentioned, that is going to increase the cost for Oregon. It's going to be in a position where we will now undo whatever good is done if Senate Bill 801 passes, because these will be multiple assessments. And for our organization, it's going to have an economic impact that would be very significantly deadly. So, ultimately it needs to be about the kids. And if, in fact, there's a better way to do things and all of that, and it means that NWA needs to adjust and needs to pursue other things and other ways to help, so be it. I would be thrilled with that. I'm a very flexible kind of guy. The process is one in which, however, if what's going on is that some folks in the dark, without any real involvement of the stakeholders of the state of Oregon, are going to make these decisions and aren't going to allow the choice of our assessment to be made by a consortium of 31 states, I think that is a decision that needs to be made through the legislative process.
Thank you. Senator Morse?
Just very quickly, because I see we're running out of time, Mr. Chair, but was there a scope of work identified and you had an opportunity to submit a proposal?
In the case of Delaware, we did.
I'm talking about the state of Oregon.
Oh, no. We have not bid on the Oaks test, and I stress we would not bid. We are not interested in being involved in accountability tests as a primary business at all. The process is one where the nature of the Oaks test has, in fact, occupied, if you will, the field. It's taken all the oxygen out of the room, and the net result is there's really no time and no money left for the kind of assessments that we deal with.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Let's call up the department and Susan Castillo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Susan Castillo, State Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of Oregon. Thank you for this opportunity to talk about assessment today. And I just want to start by joining you in your good wishes to Matt Chapman and his company. I also wish them great success and support the great work that they do. We're here today to tell you about the work of the Smarter Balanced consortia and this very important national work that is being done on behalf of the children of the United States. It really is big, important national work to help move our country forward and to address the concerns that have been expressed here today. It is about moving our country forward in doing assessment that better supports teaching and learning and has several components to it that you'll be hearing about today from Doug Costi, Assistant Superintendent at the Department. So once again, thank you for this opportunity for us to be able to share the work that we're doing. Oregon is providing national leadership in this very important work for the children of our country. And with that, I'll turn it over to Doug.
Thank you, Superintendent Castillo. Chair Haas, members of the committee. For your record, my name is Doug Costi. I'm the Assistant Superintendent of Assessment and Information Services for the Department of Education. And what I'd like to do is, if it would help the committee, give you a broad perspective of where we are today in assessment and standards movement and where we're moving, and then I can launch into the process that we took. It should take me about 10 minutes, if that works with your schedule. Let me start with the development of assessments and standards in states. Each state is currently charged with identifying content or subject area standards upon which assessments are built, and each state has to go out and secure assessments that are aligned to those standards. And those standards and assessments vary. The expectations that we have for our children vary from state to state. So part of the reason this movement occurred is so that we could get more closely aligned and our kids, for our kids' purposes, so that as kids move from state to state or within districts within a state, there are similar expectations and we can measure their performance better and more equitably. So we have been down that path. I think you've heard enough about Oaks to know that we have a web-based computer adaptive system that allows for three opportunities to test, and that's part of the concerns raised from Senate Bill 801. We are working with folks to come up with some best practice guidelines to address those concerns. But I also wanted to point out that we have taken advantage of a federal grant to build upon what Mr. Chapman was talking about with respect to Mr. Stiggins' seven essential elements. And we have used that federal money, part of the longitudinal data systems money, to improve the way teachers and administrators use assessment data on a daily basis and give them processes and procedures to follow so that they make better use of these assessments so that they can really help inform instruction. I would like to say that Oaks is not, nor have we ever proclaimed it to be formative, but I will say that some folks tend to use it in a way that might look like a formative assessment, and we are trying to ensure that that's corrected through these best practices guides and professional development throughout the state. With respect to the cost data that was raised, it costs our assessment budget is about $15.8 million per biennium, and we test 300,000 children throughout the state on an annual basis in the subject areas of math, reading, science, social science, and writing. I think Representative Comp got those points correct. I have provided a detailed breakout of what our assessment costs, and I'd be happy to the Ways and Means Committee and Legislative Fiscal Office, and if folks from this committee would like to see that worksheet, I'm happy to share that with folks as well. It's not as simple as determining what's the cost per child because of the different types of tests that are taken each year, so we have to be careful that, and I wouldn't be prepared to tell you that today, but I can give you the gross numbers. The other thing I wanted to let you know is that the AIR contract, American Institutes for Research contract, that's been referenced, was established in 2006 and was made operational in the 2007-08 school year. And that contract is renewable up to 10 years, but not beyond the 10-year scope, and which would require us to go out to bid after that point in time. So with respect to that, I'm going to launch into the process that we use to get involved with the Common Core assessments, if that's okay.
That's okay, Doug. I hate to do this to you, though, because we are time sensitive. We do have a quick work session we have to do.
Okay. I'll speed it up, and you have this written testimony.
Thank you.
For your reference, but I just wanted you to know that the State Board of Education listened to a presentation on the Common Core standards and the assessments. We obtained the signatures of the governor's office, the superintendent, and the chair of the state board to enter into a non-binding memo of understanding so that we could work on these assessments. Common Core standards were adopted by the state board at the request of districts. We heard overwhelming support for adoption of these Common Core standards. It is true Oregon is one of the chief architects in this system, and that the system has a real Northwest-based roots. States that are Washington, Oregon, Utah, and Idaho are very strong leaders in the executive committee of the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortia. There are 13 members of the Technical Advisory Committee that advise the work of this group, and they are, and two of those individuals reside in Oregon, David Conley of the University of Oregon, and Dr. Popham from UCLA, lives in Wilsonville, maintains a home here in Oregon, but is one of our technical advisors. And I'm going to stop there. The rest of the stuff is in the presentation. Comments for
them. Thank you. Senator Morrison.
Well, as I said, I think in our last meeting, given my background, it's not in education, it's in business. And you have professional differences on both sides of this issue. It's very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a large body of work that's been done. Now it's being challenged. And as a policymaker, that puts me in a very difficult position to make a reasoned judgment about what's in the best interest of our students. So I just share that. It's kind of like scope of practice issues in the professional disciplines of medicine.
Mm-hmm. If I could just respond to that. Chair Hass and Senator Morse, I very much understand what you're saying right now and understand the dilemma that you face here. I think what we're seeing is that, you know, a number of states now, over 30 states, have successfully come together to design the next generation of assessment for our children in the United States as we try to move our public education forward in the United States. And there is concern by some people about how that work is coming together, what opportunities are going to be there for people who are in the testing business. And I would say right now, I think there are many, many decisions and many opportunities for people all across the country to be a part of this very, very important work. And so I think as we move forward with this, I just want to assure you that we will we absolutely have been working with people across the state of Oregon, engaging people in this work. We will continue to do that, and we'll continue to engage the legislature in this work. We have incredibly talented technical people, policy people, not only from here in Oregon, but across the country that are engaged in this and see this as incredibly historic, important work for the country. And we see this as an incredible opportunity that we get to be a part of. And my concerns about this bill that was introduced is taking Oregon out of the conversation and being at the national table in this very, very important work. I don't believe that we want to go there. I do believe that we absolutely need to be talking to each other, working in partnership with people across the state, because there are many, many important decisions that need to get made along the way, and I assure you that we intend to do that as part of this work.
Thank you.
Senator Bonney.
Thank you. I wanted to ask if you could clarify something that came up before about the cost of the Oaks test. I believe in Representative Comp's testimony, she had submitted something saying somewhere around $11 to $13, and it said per student, and I really would like to know if that's per student per test or per student per year, and then with an anticipated, I believe it was almost $20 per student from this Smarter Balance Consortium is anticipated, and it, again, is that per student or per student per test? Per student per year, per student per test.
Chair Hass, Senator Bonamici, I'd be happy to get that information back to you.
Thank you.
I don't have it with me right now.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, and Mr. Costi, if I could request that you send it to the committee administrator, that way all the committee members can receive it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No further questions, comments. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the informational hearing on assessment. Committee, we have a bit of housekeeping. The financial have come back on Senate Bill 291 on the dash two amendments. If you could refresh us.
Certainly. Senate Bill 291.
The opening work session.
Let me open up a work session on Senate Bill 291.
Second. Senate Bill 291 that we heard testimony on before creates an expanded learning opportunities 2011 task force comprised of 26 volunteer members appointed by the governor, House of Representatives, and Senate. It requires the task force to submit a report of findings and recommendations. It allows the Department of Education to accept contributions and assistance for purposes of the task force, declares emergency effective on passage. We have since had a dash two amendment, which incorporates a dash one amendment adopted by this committee on March 10th, and it changes one task force member from the Oregon Pre-Engineering and Applied Science Initiative Group to a representative from the Oregon University System Chancellor's Office. And the dash two changes the sunset date from a specific date of February 4th, 2013, to the date of the convening of the 2013 regular legislative session. Those are the changes.
Okay, we adopted dash ones. We need to do the dash twos.
Correct.
Senator Bonamici, you were riding herd on this. Is there anything you want to say before
no,
we...
No, just Mr. Chair, this is a continuation of the work that the Supporting Student Success Team began with a grant from NTSL and... National Governors Association, and I know it looks like a big task force, but Mr. Chair and committee members, there are a lot of people who wanted to be around the table, and it really is extended learning opportunities really are community efforts, and so I think it makes sense to have a lot of people around the table for this discussion. There's quite a bit of momentum already on this, Mr. Chair, so I urge passage. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Senator Morse?
No, Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the dash two amendments on Senate Bill 291 dated April 12, 2011.
Senator Morse moves to adopt the dash two amendments dated April 12, 2011 to Senate Bill 291. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the dash twos are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 291 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morse moves Senate Bill 291 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Bonamici?
I just wanted to say that it's Oregon After School Kids Day today in the Capitol, and so after we adopt this, I would like invite everyone to go out to the gallery and see their display so you can really understand some of the important work that the Extended Learning Opportunity groups are doing.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, Measure Senate Bill 291 passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Senator Bonamici will be the carrier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, another full day. Thank you all.
Oh, we need to go forward.
And let me make sure I re-announce that we are carrying over bills 170, Senate Bill 240, Senate Bill 333, Senate Bill 801, Senate Bill 245, and Senate Joint Resolution 4. And if there's no other business, we are adjourned.